Welcome to VOA's International Edition. I'm Susan Yawkey in Washington. Coming up, we hear about the humanitarian struggles of those trapped by the battle for Fallujah. Our State Department reporter shares details of the U.S. Secretary's upcoming trip. Concern about the use of drones by the United States military. And a senior editor from Entertainment Tonight speaks with us about Johnny Depp's marital problems.
Kind of a he said, she said, what's the real truth? And now we're just really starting to realize that there's basically three sides to this story.
It's all on today's International Edition. Islamic State fighters are putting up stiff resistance to an Iraqi military offensive to liberate the western city of Fallujah. Iraq's counterterrorism service, regular army units, and Shiite militia, backed by airstrikes, began their assault Monday from three directions. IS fighters have occupied the city since January 2014. Baghdad insists dozens of IS fighters have been killed but declined to provide Iraqi casualties. The fierce fighting has raised concerns over the fate of an estimated 50,000 residents, including an estimated 20,000 children, still believed trapped in Fallujah and lacking access to food and health care. Lisa Grande is the deputy special representative of the UN Assistance Mission for Iraq.
We understand that there are widespread food shortages, and there have been since January, when access to Fallujah became extremely difficult for commercial convoys. I think we would characterize this as is mass food deprivation. Some of the families that have managed to escape have said, look, we cut down to one meal a day in February. By March, we were having to skip meals every two or three days. And sometimes in the course of the week, we're only eating on one, two, at most 3 days of the week.
Jan Egeland, Secretary General of the Norwegian Refugee Council, said a human catastrophe is unfolding inside Fallujah. VOA's Victor Beatty spoke with Council Member Carl Shembri in Amman.
We're hearing horrible stories about people who are being either executed or caught in the crossfire or not being allowed to flee their houses from the city center. The people we've received in our displacement camps, now almost 600 families have reached our camps, are all coming from the outskirts of Fallujah. Those who are inside are still trapped, and we are extremely worried about the situation.
What is the food situation?
Extremely dire. People are telling us that they haven't been able to eat food for months on end, except for dried dates or rotting dates, drinking river water, unable to feed their children, their babies. Baby milk has become impossible to buy. It's too expensive. Rice has almost run out, and it's also too expensive for people to buy. And again, the families who are reaching our displacement camps are just relieved, even though they've left everything behind. They're just sighing with relief at the fact that they are out of the battle zone right now and that they can get something finally to eat in months.
There are reports that some, perhaps in the hundreds, could be rounded up by Islamic State and being used as human shields.
We are getting such reports from the people who have fled. It is impossible to know the full extent of the situation unfolding inside Fallujah. We have been unable to enter Fallujah for months now. That's why it's been cut off, besieged, cut off from aid, from supplies, essential supplies, including medical supplies, which have run out.
Carl, in a related development, Reuters news agency is reporting that the UN World Food Program is working on plans that up to 700,000 people could be displaced by a planned offensive to retake Iraq's second biggest city, Mosul, from Islamic State.
Well, we've been hearing reports of the government's intention to launch such an operation. So what is concerning us as a humanitarian agency is that across all of Iraq, there are already 3.4 million people displaced. 10 million Iraqis need some kind of humanitarian assistance. So whatever happens, these civilians cannot be abandoned. Once again, just the funding for the needs of the emergency needs of the Iraqis is just 30% funded for this year. We cannot cope. It's impossible. And the international community needs to step up its funding for the humanitarian response.
Carl Shembri says his group calls on the warring sides to respect international humanitarian law and allow safe passage for civilians to flee, and permit the opening of humanitarian corridors for aid to flow into those trapped by the fighting in Fallujah. I'm joined now here at the anchor desk with our social media reporter, Andrew Palchevsky, and he has some breaking news for us about the Air Egypt flight. Andrew, what's going on?
Yeah, well, we're getting word that the Egypt Air Flight 804, the black boxes from that flight that crashed in the Mediterranean, they apparently have been discovered, or at least they've discovered what they call a ping from those black boxes, which they're hoping is the signal that will lead them to the black boxes somewhere in the Mediterranean. And with that, there's a lot of hope on social media that they'll find out answers as to why this plane crashed. Over the past few weeks, there's been a lot of mystery that's continued, a lot of speculation that's continued on social media as to why this plane, flying along seemingly no problems, and then crashed in the Mediterranean, killing all of those aboard. So there's hope that there may be some answers that come with this discovery and some closure also for the families.
Right. What else is going on today?
Well, the name Mary Meeker is trending. Now, I've never heard of Mary Meeker, but she's a very interesting story. She's a venture capitalist, and every year she puts out this kind of trends in the Internet report. It's called the Internet Trends Report. And it's just came out and is very long. It's 213 slides that she puts together.
Wow.
So I looked through it as fast as I could before I came in here, but I pulled out some key stats. But basically, it gives you a picture of where the Internet is today and where the Internet is going, kind of the state of the Internet. So one of the facts that I thought was very interesting, she said that 3 billion people around the world are using the Internet. That's about 42% of the world population. But the growth is flat. Except for India. India, there's a lot of growth in number of people using the Internet, but overall around the world, growth is generally kind of flat. One of the things she's noting, and a lot of people are jumping on, especially economists and people who work with stocks and trading and investing in companies, are smartphones. She's saying that smartphone usage is kind of cooling off, and smartphone shipments, not as many people are buying smartphones.
I guess if you wanted one, you already have it.
Yeah, exactly. There's the term they use is market saturation. They're wondering if enough people already have them, that there's how many more people can purchase them. So that's for Apple and for Samsung, some of the smartphone makers, that's a concern for them. So we're going to see a lot more information kind of dripping out from this report as people sift through all 213 of those slides.
Wow.
But it's a fascinating read if people want to go online and find it. Once again, it's the 2016 Internet Trends Report. A lot of interesting information about the state of the net.
The phone people are going to have to come up with some new bells and whistles to draw back more purchasers.
Absolutely. And I'm sure they're already planning that as we speak.
Okay. Thank you, Andrew.
Thank you.
In the news, witnesses say a car bomb has exploded outside a major hotel in Somalia's capital, and gunmen have stormed the building. Some 20,000 children are believed to be trapped in Fallujah. Iraq is fighting rages for control of the city that Islamic State militants seized more than 2 years ago. Egyptian aviation officials say a French ship picked up signals likely emitted from the black boxes of an Egypt airplane that crashed in the Mediterranean last month. About half of France's train traffic was halted today as rail workers went on strike to protest their working conditions and propose changes to French labor rules. News, feature reports, and more are at voanews.com.
Here's Science in a Minute.
About 21% of world electricity generation is estimated to be from non-fossil fuels such as the wind or sun. But scientists hope to boost that number by looking at new ways to create it, one of which involves food waste. A team of researchers found that damaged or spoiled tomatoes can be turned into a unique and powerful source of renewable energy when fed to biological and microbial electrochemical cells. And the good news is, there seems to be a nearly endless supply of damaged and rotten tomatoes, since Florida alone generates 359,245 metric tons of tomato waste each year. The scientists admit that right now the power produced by their tomato-fueled energy cells is quite small. But they're quite optimistic that, with continued research, they'll be able to greatly increase the electrical output of their energy cells. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry is heading out Thursday on another whirlwind trip from France to Mongolia to China. Reporter Nike Ching joins us on the line from state headquarters to fill us in on what he hopes to accomplish. Welcome, Nike.
Thank you, Susan.
Let's start in Paris, where the secretary will be focusing on Middle East peace.
Exactly. Remember more than 2 years ago in April of 2014, when a peace process that he brokered fell apart, Secretary Kerry did not give up hope for a lasting agreement to end the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. And then he did not give up the vision of a two states for two peoples, living side by side in peace and security. Now, the French-led initiative on June 3rd is aimed at helping to move beyond the current stalemate. The participants will include ministers and delegates from the so-called Middle East Quartet, that is the United States, Russia, the European Union, and the United Nations. The gathering of the ministers is planned to pave the way for an international conference to set new parameters for negotiating a Palestinian state alongside Israel.
Then it's off to Ulaanbaatar, Mongolia. What will Kerry be doing there?
Interesting. He will arrive on a rare destination of his globe-trotting career as a top U.S. diplomat in Mongolia, where he will meet with the high-level senior government officials. And Kerry will also host a town hall with young leaders and attend a traditional Mongolia cultural festival. Now, Mongolia is interestingly located between two big countries, China and Russia. China and Russia are the big single-party regimes, and Mongolia has a very young democracy and maintains a very good relations, majorly the trade and cultural relations with the United States. Susan.
The final stop, Beijing, but there have been some tensions recently between the U.S. and China.
Exactly, and the timing is, as some analysts think, is very diplomatically inconvenient, because the high-level talk of the so-called U.S.-China strategic and economic dialogue will take place on June 6 to 7, which is 2 days after the 27th anniversary of the Tiananmen Square incident. The United States will not gloss over thorny issues with China. They will include the human rights practice, South China Sea tensions, and cybersecurity. The United States senior officials are expected to raise concerns over a new Chinese law that will manage foreign non-governmental organizations and low civil society organizations and their Chinese partners to operate in China. Now, in South China Sea, anxieties have been growing in the region over China's aggressive approach to its territorial claims in disputed waters in the South China Sea. Although experts think the narrowing between Washington and Beijing in this hot issue is not likely, it is helpful to talk. Susan?
Well, thank you very much, Nike, for speaking with us today from the State Department.
You're welcome.
Coming up on International Edition, renewed calls for transparency of drone use and a look at news out of Hollywood. From the recent U.S. strike in Pakistan that killed the leader of the Afghan Taliban to a March strike in Somalia that killed at least 150 members of the militant group al-Shabaab, the United States has escalated its use of drones under President Barack Obama. The administration is preparing to release for the first time an accounting of those killed in such strikes. In this television report, VOA correspondent Aru Pandey has more on the expectations of transparency for a program long shrouded in secrecy.
From this remote American base in New Mexico State, where U.S. Air Force pilots launch Predator drones, to the targets themselves, human rights groups have long called for hard numbers when it comes to counterterrorism strikes that until recently the administration refused to even confirm. Human Rights First Rita Simeon.
Saying, just trust us, we have high standards, we're doing the best that we can, really isn't enough, and that they need to be disclosing more.
The Obama administration has promised as much with a soon-to-be-released report outlining the number of combatants and civilians killed in U.S. drone strikes since 2009, outside areas of active hostilities like Iraq, Afghanistan, and Syria. But for Human Rights First Saimian, tallying casualties is not enough. She says the administration should clarify terms like combatant, imminent threat, and feasibility of capture while taking further steps to codify its drone policy.
All of that work that they have done over the years to set standards, to set boundaries, they need to codify that into an order so that Obama does not leave as his legacy sort of boundless, endless, forever war.
Foundation for Defense of Democracy's John Hanna served as senior advisor in the Clinton administration and the George W. Bush administration, which was criticized for the creation of the Guantanamo Bay military prison.
The Obama administration has almost completely foregone an effort to capture and detain and get intelligence from these terrorists. Instead, it's unilaterally decided that it's going to be the judge, jury, and executioner.
Still, he says, drone strikes are an effective tactic in countries like Yemen and Pakistan, where the government is either unwilling or unable to go after terrorists, minimizing civilian casualties compared to conventional military conflict. The key, Hanna says, is balance.
Ensure that we're doing everything possible and creating all the necessary institutions and safeguards to find the right balance that ensures American security and yet at the same time ensures that we're not crossing that line into becoming a lawless nation.
A challenge that analysts say will continue into the future, with the use of drones now a central component of U.S. counterterrorism policy. Aru Pandey, VOA News, Washington.
This is VOA.
Health news and notes. This is Living Better.
At Al Auda Hospital in the northern Gaza Strip, a young patient is being prepped for hand surgery. It's being guided by a doctor hundreds of kilometers away in Beirut using an online interactive platform for tablet computers called Proximy. A specialist, Dr. Ghassan Abu Sitta, directs the surgery.
The images will be on my iPad, on which I will be drawing where the surgeon should cut on the other side to be able to do the operation.
Proximy co-founder Nadine Hachacharam says the technology makes medical expertise more accessible.
This platform is for all the countries in the world, not only for the countries with no access or for countries asking for expertise from abroad. This is for everyone.
Proximy has been used in the United States, UK, Peru, and Vietnam, and now in Gaza. I'm Martin Seacrest for VOA's Living Better.
There's a lot of buzz about one particular Hollywood actor whose wife just gave a deposition to police about abuse. Joining VOA's Lori London to talk about it is Entertainment Tonight senior editor Jennifer Peros.
Obviously, the big story that everybody has been talking about almost for the past week is Johnny Depp and his split from his wife of just 15 months, Amber Heard. And there's been a lot of back and forth between the two actors, kind of a he said, she said, what's the real truth? And now we're just really starting to realize that there's basically three sides to the story, his version, her version, and the truth. So what we know so far, we had just confirmed on ET Online, is I'm sure you remember when Johnny had broken his hand March of last year while he was filming Pirates of the Caribbean 5 out in Australia. Everybody, it was this mysterious hand injury, and the movie studio basically confirmed and released a statement that something happened off set where Johnny broke his hand and he needed to fly to the United States for last-minute surgery. And what we have just confirmed today from multiple sources is that Johnny actually had injured his hand from punching a wall during an argument with Amber. We know that, you know, production was halted for about a month. Amber then had left Australia to head to London to film The Danish Girl. So I think there's a lot more things that are going to come out of this nasty split, and I don't think it's going to quiet down anytime soon.
Wow, so sad all the way around.
Really is sad. And, you know, a lot of people close to Johnny are coming to his defense. I mean, his ex-girlfriend and the mother of his children, Vanessa Paradis, had come out this past weekend in a letter to TMZ and said, you know, Johnny had never physically, verbally attacked me at all. He was never violent towards me or our children. I'd never seen that side of him. And then Johnny's daughter, Lily Rose, who we hear is a very close friend of Amber's, said, you know, my father would never hurt a fly. He is the nicest man I've ever met. So a lot more interesting things to come out of this story, I'm sure, in the near future.
Any other big stories you guys are working on?
Yeah, again, more sad news. I'm so sorry. More sad news out of Los Angeles. Of course, the former S.H.I.E.L.D. actor Michael Jace was finally convicted after a week-long trial of second-degree murder of his wife, April. We are hearing that the incident happened in front of the couple's two young children 2 years ago. There was a lot of back and forth of what really happened. You know, Michael had said it kind of was, he took a shotgun out and just wanted to shoot her in the leg to scare her a little bit, and that turned into three shots that eventually killed her. So an incredibly sad story, something that two young children should never have to see, and the famous actor was finally found guilty. And he's going to appear court for sentencing on June 10th, and he could face 40 years to life in a state prison.
Entertainment Tonight senior editor Jennifer Perros. We would like to invite you to follow us on Twitter. You can find us at @VOA_IE. If you would like to listen to today's program again or any previous broadcast, please visit our website at voanews.com. Go to the Programs tab in the upper right-hand corner, then scroll down to International Edition. Thanks for joining us.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Law enforcement and the rule of law in Pakistan got a boost recently with some assistance from the United States. Last month, U.S. Ambassador to Pakistan David Hale and Pakistan Economic Affairs Division Secretary Tariq Bajwa signed a one-year $48.6 million bilateral assistance agreement. Under the agreement, the U.S. Department of State's International Narcotics and Law Enforcement Affairs Bureau will provide support to the government of Pakistan in building Pakistan's law enforcement capability, fighting illicit narcotics, and strengthening its criminal justice system. The United States signed the first such bilateral assistance agreement in 1982. Subsequent yearly agreements have supported the training of tens of thousands of police officers and prosecutors, construction of police stations, and provision of vehicles, equipment, and life-saving personal protective gear for law enforcement agents. The new agreement will fund several programs throughout Pakistan, including initiatives to improve the capability and reach of provincial police and other law enforcement institutions through training, equipment, and infrastructure support. Programs will also support women's access to the justice system, as well as support the recruitment, retention, and advancement of women as police officers, prosecutors, and judges. In addition, programs will help Pakistan interdict illegal narcotics, arrest and prosecute drug traffickers, fund crop substitution and agricultural training programs for poppy farmers, and provide small-scale irrigation, hydroelectric systems, and farm-to-market roads in Khyber Pakhtunkhwa province and the federally administered tribal areas. Lastly, it will promote rule of law by providing training to provincial and federal prosecutors and judges in effective trial advocacy and to corrections officials in modern prison administration. The Bureau of International Narcotics and Law Enforcement Affairs works in more than 90 countries to help them combat crime and corruption, counter drug-related crime, improve police institutions, and promote laws and court systems that are fair and accountable. The United States is proud to work with its partner, Pakistan, to support a criminal justice system that serves and protects the people of Pakistan.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.